appreciate all the veterans are doing for America's military families in time of hardship. I appreciate your compassion. Across our country, local chapters of the American Legion, for example, are stepping forward to help those families in practical ways, from making household repairs to helping with child care. Members of the VFW and Auxiliary are sending care packages with baby supplies to military families. Operation Uplink program is helping thousands of service members keep in touch with their loved ones. Both the American Legion and the VFW are working with the USA Freedom Corps on a project called On the Home Front. This effort will match Americans who want to volunteer their times and skills with the military families who need help. Because of all this generosity, our men and women serving overseas will know that their loved ones are not facing this time alone. I want to thank the veterans groups for understanding the compassion needed to help those who are here wondering and worrying about their loved ones overseas. The people who serve in the military are giving their best to this country, and we have the responsibility to give them our full support. Our full support not only here in Washington, D.C., but our support all across the country. I want to thank each veteran here today and across our land.
Stage in human history when this psyops rhetoric by a buffoon flies over the heads of the masses. You GIs are expendable. Iraqi people are expendable. Humanity under the wheels of this imperial machine is expendable. You are as disposable to them as a soiled piece of toilet paper. We are in a permanent stage of war with no end in foreseeable sight. Locked into the grips of this dollar and chains apparatus, where Sam's G.I. Joes and Janes are mere stooges, puppets, on this grand chessboard game of imperialism. Slave revolt or die. You know what time it is. Check this. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 freakradio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz, 104.1 Berkeley. Check out 107.5, 96.3. Click into propagandapress.org, savagejustice.blogspot.com, and our radioforall.net, the universe. Find out what time it is. Tonight we're going to explore the disposable G.I. Joe syndrome that's gripping America and the planet. We got all that and hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave revolt.
attention. Seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Based in intra-false flag operations for the larger and long-range goals of the Order. The G.I. Joes and Janes are mere expendable flesh-coated puppets being maneuvered on the global grand chessboard of Empire. In this Beyond the Shadow segment called Disposable GIs, the puppeteers' playthings on the Imperial Grand Chessboard of the Middle East. The slave revolt will try to break down some of these sorted details and sort through this deadly maze. First, let me just start off by breaking down what I see as what is going down through the various stages of the Imperial occupation and the war in Iraq in a larger Mideast theater. The G.I. Joes and Janes role to me is not really to defeat the insurgents. In reality, their role is to defeat the Iraqi people, i.e. to destroy the intelligentsia of the Iraqi population, the doctors, the lawyers, to disrupt, demoralize the workers within those societies, to confuse the labor class, to have them stressed out, to displace millions internally and externally, to cause chaos amongst the students' ranks, and have generational brain drainage throughout the country, so that Iraq is no longer a functional society and is more easily and readily broken up, which is part of the Empire's grand design. The role of the U.S. military and the military's personnel does not have to be conscious overall of these elements, they for the most part are often just caught in the quagmire themselves of empire, often just trying to survive day to day, navigate their way through the maze, and the only thing they really have to hold on to is a bloody stained flag of false patriotism. In essence, they're nothing more than flesh-colored and covered puppets. It's often best from the Empire standpoint that they don't know the reality, that they are confused in the illusion of fighting the good war, fighting the right fight. So, part of the role of this military occupation is to create what I basically see as a permanent occupational stress order disorder syndrome. What this causes in areas like Iraq is societal breakdown. Just by their occupation, you have societal breakdowns. Just by not allowing people to go back to work, firing large segments of the population from their regular jobs, students not going back to work, you end up having frustration, and often young males end up forming their own cliques, survival cliques, similar to what you see in occupational mode in urban centers where gangs form, and they are extremely territorial, brutal, and their survival instinct is not based off of any kind of long range strategy. It's based off of the day-to-day reality that they face. They are thereby easily manipulated in these grand chessboard games of the empire to end up becoming flesh puppets in the empire's war on terrorism, war on crime, war on gangs, war on guns. So as people, young people, especially men, turn into forms of banditry and little cliques, tribalized cliques, in Iraq, hocus pocus cliques, in South Central LA, regional subsets of Crips and Bloods, Eighth Trey gangsters, and all of these types of things. Then you end up having additional stress by the occupation and breakdown of the communities take forward, where people become demoralized. And it becomes like a free-for-all. Anything goes. Women are often the most victimized people within that society, within the occupational mode. The military or the police in these situations in urban centers, but the military in the Iraq mode is then in the process of arresting as much of the male population as possible, criminalizing him from Iraq to South Central to Oakland. We see the same process, all under the guise of fighting terrorism, fighting gangs, fighting drugs. This puts additional stress and helps further escalate the siege mentality, where the population that is already in a form of permanent occupational stress disorder syndrome is easily manipulated by charlatans and banditries. The mercenaries' role within this is also to intensify the killers for hire in a world for sale. They are part also, though, of the Praetorian Guard for the elite, the protectorate for the ambassadors, for the administrators for empire, as we see in Iraq and as we saw in New Orleans. They help spread chaos and help in the process of deflating the Iraqi population by making it clear that their presence is vulnerable and not really welcome. From Iraq to New Orleans, these killers for hire and a world for sale also help commodify the privatization of everything by the elite, and help within that spectrum be part of the empire's network of shadow mercenary governments and protectorates, as we saw in New Orleans under Hurricane Sam. Blackwater and other mercenaries helped intensify the chaos. They were the Praetorian Guard for the Old Line family. They helped defeat the black population. The occupational tone in New Orleans by these killers for hire made it clear in their message that the population was not wanted, was expendable. The mercenaries are part of the shock troop apparatus. Within that spectrum, we also have the covert operations and operatives who serve to hide in the shadows of Sam's imperial covert spreading of disaster, misery, and genocide, to turn the masses even deeply upon themselves and have no clue what is happening. From their counterintelligence program in the urban areas, the Salvadorian options that are taking place in Iraq by black ops operators, the CIA, certain mercenary forces, and secretive U.S. military forces. The program is all the same. This all ties in with the administrators for the elite order, the Condoleezza Rices, Tony Snows, the Bill O'Reillys, the corporate media, the Democrats, Republicans, groups like MoveOn.org. They help maintain legitimacy and deception, confusion about the permanent war command mode that we're really in, that is designed to expand the war at all costs, at the expense of Mideast people and humanity, and yes, also at the expense for the flesh-covered puppets, the G.I. Joes and Janes. These are some of the realities that we are truly gripped up in. One of the first things that Sam did in Iraq was dissolve the military. 250,000 were just thrown out into the dust. Intentionally, Sam fired all the civil workers who were connected with the Ba'ath Party. That's part of the strategy of chaos. They help foment the permanent occupational stress disorder syndrome that we see now. This is a quagmire by design, because the quagmire is an apparatus intended to expand this genocidal war is not a quagmire out of missteps by the empire. Within this context, we can see how both the Democrats and Republicans are playing games of conflict while both benefit as administrators for the Imperial War Expansion Order. It is also clear how expendable U.S. GI puppets are in some of the most brutal details when this is put in context to their miserable plight, suffrage, and lack of basic human rights. On the Imperial Iraqi plantation.
Die in the Iraq War.
At the time, the military was quick to point out her death was not combat related. Now, since then, her parents have struggled to find out, well, what did happen. Tonight, Matt Sesney takes a close look at the evidence gathered by the military and asks the question, was it murder or suicide?
Among the thousands of graves at Jefferson Barracks Cemetery, there are stories of bravery, heroism, and proud service. And among the thousands is the grave of Private Lavina Johnson, whose story is clouded in mystery, and according to her parents, marred by murder and cover-up.
Right now, that's probably the emotion that's driving me right now, is the anger that I feel that my daughter would go in the army to serve her country, and she gets murdered, I mean brutalized, and they turned on her.
Lavina's father, Dr. John Johnson, has waged his own personal crusade to find out what really happened to his daughter in Iraq on July 19, 2005. The Army ruled her death a suicide, the victim of a gunshot wound to the head. But in documents and autopsy photos obtained by the Johnson family and shared with News 4, more questions are raised than answered.
First of all, the mere fact that physically she was abused. Physically. And the autopsy didn't really address the physical trauma to her body. I thought that was peculiar.
For instance?
The broken nose. She had what looked to be a dislocated elbow or a dislocated shoulder.
Military documents also show no apparent indication of suicide. Her company commander writing, Johnson was clearly happy and healthy physically and emotionally, something her mother knew by a phone conversation the day before she died.
We laughed. We talked about Christmas, and we were making plans.
Johnson's parents also question how their daughter at 5'1" could have handled a 40-inch M16 to kill herself while sitting. In fact, a military laboratory even concluded that based on a gunshot residue test, Johnson may not have even handled the weapon. Additionally, Johnson's military debit card was never found, even though she used it just 2 hours before her death to buy candy. No bullet was ever found where she died, and a trail of blood is seen in photos outside the tent. And even stranger, it appears someone tried to set her body on fire.
Whoever did this tried to burn her up, and there was a second fire in that tent. So they also tried to burn the whole crime scene down.
So if it wasn't a suicide, as the Army maintains, how did Private Lavina Johnson die? Well, based on the documents and autopsy photos obtained from the government, her father believes it started with a sexual assault.
I believe she got scared. She went to have a physical to see if she had any kind of sexually transmitted disease. I believe she gave a name. I believe somebody leaked that name out, and then somebody made good on their practice to murder her.
But the military is unconvinced and consider the case closed. A Pentagon spokesman saying the case was investigated thoroughly and there is no evidence to reopen. Now, we for weeks to get the Army to say more about the death of Private Johnson, but their only response is that the investigation is closed. Certainly, though, the documents military investigators have gathered seem to say more. Johnson's father is now trying to have her body exhumed at Jefferson Barracks to have an independent autopsy performed. It is a story we will continue to follow. Larry?
as you can see, the fact that you strap on that GI uniform doesn't mean that you are not expendable, even at the hands of fellow GIs. Lavina Johnson was clearly murdered, unless she shot herself and then tried to burn herself up after she was already dead, and then tried to burn up the whole crime scene after she was already dead, and somehow managed to do this with a broken nose and a broken or dislocated elbow and or shoulder, with no bullet casing found. But see, as pointed out, Lavina's father believes she was sexually assaulted, gave a name, and it was leaked out. And Lavina paid with her life. A study by the National Guard and Reserve Forces found that almost 1 in 4 women have been assaulted or raped within these forces. 2006, almost 3,000 soldiers reported sexual assault. Many women don't report their sexual assault for fear it will affect their careers. They even have a term for this type of assault. It's called MST, military sexual trauma. Percent of men have experienced military sexual trauma. 60% of women have. 3.5% of men have experienced military sexual assault. 23% of women have experienced military sexual assault. 11% of women have experienced rape. 1.2% of men have experienced rape. Be all you can be. In reality, by the Pentagon's and military's own action and lack of, you're a disposable flesh puppet. That's the reality. And if these forms of exploitation of women and men were not enough, Sarah Rich and her mom know all too well about the command rape game in America's military.
Well, you know, my daughter is still in the military, so it's been a long haul. It's been 3.5 years now. But one of the first things that happened when she got to Kuwait was her platoon sergeant started propositioning her for sex. And then she decided, she said no, and went and told, and nobody helped her. And then she gets to Iraq, and her squad leader starts coercing into a sexual relationship, which is called command rape, and the person who has life or death decision making over you in a combat zone coerces you into sex. It's like incest.
Your supervisor in whatever civilian job you have preyed upon you as a employee. If the boss of the bank, and you worked at the bank as a teller in the bank, started harassing you or forcing you into sex to keep your job. There are some parallels to it in a way, but I think in the military it's a little more dangerous because your supervisors really control your destiny and your safety.
So she goes along into this, and when it finally ends, he starts punishing her the way she thought he would if she didn't comply or didn't go along with it. And basically made her life a living hell for the rest of her deployment, you know, to the end where she felt suicidal. I didn't know what to do. I called my congressman to get help because I didn't know how to save her or what to do. And I said, you know, he's willing to help. His congressman is willing to help. But you have to sign a privacy act later. She said, Mom, that would not be good for me to do that. So I backed off and just sent more Rice Krispie treats and anything I could do to keep her spirits up until she got back in February 2005. And then she gets back and I said, now can we do something about the molester? Because I always called this one person the molester. And she said, no, I have to read the play with these guys in 18 months. And it's not good for me, for anybody to tell. It's not safe. So she goes back and is an MP of Fort Lewis. And she's in a new unit with a new squad leader, a new team leader. And this guy starts calling her up in the middle of the night, asking her what color underwear she wears, you know. And then one time she went and she says, Sergeant, where do you want me to report in the morning? And he said, in my bed naked. And she had had it. You know, she was tired of him harassing her, so she went and told again. They did this investigation and basically told her she was a liar, and this other person was a liar. And she was made to do role plays, you know, to show what you're supposed to do to discourage sexual advances in the military. Whereas the man who was harassing her got a letter of reprimand put in his file and transferred to another unit. And the worst thing of it was, is then she was seen as a traitor by the rest of her unit because she told on their buddy. And that was really hard for her. So she goes along and continues to work as an MP, and then she tells me she's being redeployed. I said, well, wait, you know, that's not, you're supposed to have 18 months between deployments, you know, for stabilization time. And she said, well, I had to sign a waiver waiving my rights to stabilization time. I'm going, you know. And I said, well, you don't have to, you know, I can work with your congressman again. And she says, no, I'm just going to go. You know, so 11 months after her return from her first deployment, she was getting ready to go again. And it was 3 days before she was going to leave. And she had her keys in her hand, her car was packed, my husband had checked the oil, she was going back to Fort Lewis. And she looked at me in the kitchen and she says, I don't think I can do it. And I go, seriously? She says, I can't go back. And I said, well, good, let's get you the hell out of there. We're continuing her therapy because she was doing some therapy with this psychologist weekly and just trying to find a way for her to be strong enough to go back and face what she had to face. And then the military sent a pickup order to the Eugene Police Department. They came to my house. She happened to be there 10:30 at night on a Sunday night, and they took her away in handcuffs. And up until that moment, we hadn't spoken out about what happened to her in Iraq because it just didn't feel safe. And plus, it's her story, and I'm going to wait for her to say it's okay to talk about it. So the minute they're leading her out, you know, in her pajamas with her handcuffs on, I said, now? And she said, no. And so I got on the phone, and I got onto the computer, and I told everybody that they'd taken my daughter, that she had been AWOL, she'd been sexually abused in the military, and I needed help. She was sentenced to 30 days in the brig and stripped of all of her rank.
Now, this is how it plays out in the real world. Now, think of all that rhetoric that Boy George was saying at the beginning before I blew him up. But here's the reality. Your mental health is not essential or important to them. Your physical health is immaterial. Your disposable, flesh-covered puppets, pawns and pieces on the Empire's grand chessboard. And what came of the G.I. Joes that were sexually exploiting and command-raping Sarah?
One of them is still there in the 54th MP company. In fact, when they took her back, when the MP people came and took her back to Fort Lewis, they put him as her supervisor, and we had to get an order to a no-contact order so that she wouldn't have to deal with him because he was very intimidating and scary. And so that was one person who's still in the military, and the other two are not in the military anymore. One of them, the molester, is in Blackwater making $15,000 a month.
$15,000 a month as a killer for hire in a world for sale. That's how it works in the real world. That's how it's supposed to work. Because the stability of the GIs is not essential to their overall plan. Your soiled toilet paper. Just like Todd Bowers, a Marine who was sent on two tours in Iraq and found his student loans while he was out in Iraq were sent to collections. Or this one brother that we covered before, who once he stepped into the military, lost his status as a brother and was reduced to a flesh-covered puppet, Felipe Luis John, a Marine, a killer for Empire. He served during the first invasion strike. He was born in Haiti and came to Sam's plantation around the age of 5. He has a green card. Both parents are U.S. citizens. But one day, the sergeant called him in and informed him that immigration officials were on their way. They arrested Felipe for, quote, cheating on his wife. He had sexual relations with someone while he was separated from his wife. He was thrown in a brig for 37 days at that initial time. Then he went on later to go fight in the Iraq war. But the sergeant who had it in for him, because he just didn't like immigrants and thought him and others were disposable, called the immigration officials on him after he got back fighting for Sam. And off to the brig he went. There's an estimate 35,000 non-citizens fighting for the U.S. Empire. And all that rhetoric they talk about how this will open new doors for you. In reality, like Felipe, it may be a jail cell door or a door to one of our West Oakland head coffins. Yet, as we've come to find out, like in this August 26, 2007 piece by the Arizona Daily Star, by Carla McLean, that cancer in Iraq vets raises possibility of toxic exposure. Quote, after serving in Vietnam nearly 40 years ago and receiving the Bronze Star for it, the Tuscan soldier was called back to active duty in Iraq. While there, he awoke one morning with a sore throat. 18 months later, Army Sergeant James Lauderdale was dead of a bizarrely aggressive cancer rarely seen by the doctors who tried to treat him. As a result, his stunned and heartbroken family has joined growing ranks of sickening and dying Iraqi war vets and their families who believe exposures to toxic poisons in the war zone are behind their illnesses, mostly cancers, striking the young, taking them down with alarming speed. The number of these cancers remains undisclosed, with military officials citing patients' privacy issues as well as a lack of evidence. The cases are linked to conditions in the war zone. The U.S. Congress has ordered a probe of suspect toxins and may soon begin widespread testing of our armed forces. May. Later in the article, it describes how fast it spread, how aggressive. One of the doctors said that they had never seen anything like it. that this happens, quote, in only 1% of cases. She said efforts to contact his doctors at Walter Reed were unsuccessful. But a leading head and neck cancer specialist at the Arizona Cancer Center reviewed the course of Lauderdale's disease. Quote, "This is a very wrenching case," said Dr. Herringer Garwell. "This is unusually aggressive behavior for oral cancer. I would agree it happens in only 1% of the cases." But don't count on the barbarians trying to detoxify the battlefield, because the battle must go on. And as a flesh-covered puppet, the reality is you're expendable. But as Richard Stengel in Time magazine on August 30th, 2007 tries to outline to the masses, it's a time to serve. Create a national service baby bond is one of his things. Number two, make national service a cabinet level department. For the creating of a national service baby bond, he states, every time an American baby is born, the federal government would invest $5,000 into the child's name in a 529 type fund. That money could be assessed between the ages of 18 and 25 on the condition that he or she commit to at least 1 year of national or military service. So they can end up like Sarah Rich? Like Lauderdale? Like Lavina Johnson? Flesh-covered puppets. Disposable for empire. But as we all know, the saga continues with this disposable GIs. As new details on Tillman's death by Martha Mendoza have come forward in the Associated Press, she states Army medical examiners were suspicious about the close proximity of 3 bullet holes in Pat Tillman's forehead and tried without success to get authorities to investigate whether the former NFL player's death amounted to a crime, according to documents obtained by the Associated Press. Quote, the medical evidence did not match up with the scenario as described, unquote, a doctor who examined Tillman's body after he was killed on the battlefield in Afghanistan in 2004 told investigators. The doctors, whose names were blacked out, said the bullet holes were so close together that it appeared the Army Ranger was cut down by M16 fire from a mere 10 yards away or so. Ultimately, the Pentagon did conduct a criminal investigation and asked Tillman's comrades whether he was disliked by his men and whether they had any reason to believe he was deliberately killed. The Pentagon eventually ruled that Tillman's death at the hands of his comrades was a friendly fire accident. The medical examiner's suspicions were outlined in 2,300 pages of testimony released to the AP this week by the Defense Department in response to the Freedom of Information Act. Yet, the reality is that other evidence has shown that in a memo that not all was well in what the military had initially and even more currently has been claiming. As another article states, Tillman's memo contradicted citation. McChrystal told the investigators that he believed Tillman deserved the award for getting gunned down, and that he wanted to warn top U.S. military and political leaders that friendly fire was a possibility. Because I thought it was friendly fire, I thought it was important that key attendees know that the theory could become the finding of the investigation. And if they were going to make a statement about, quote, killed by enemy fire, unquote, it might not be certain, McChrystal said. The secret back-channel message was a memo known as P4 that McChrystal wrote on April 29, 2004 to General John Abazi, head of Central Command, and to two other generals. The P4 noted rumors that Bush had other top officials might include comments about Corporal Tillman's heroism and had approved Silver Star Medal in speeches. But later, moving down on this article, it states that McChrystal was then and remains commander of the Covert Joint Special Operations Command, the military's clandestine Black Ops Corps, which fights in the shadows of battles in Iraq, Afghanistan, and beyond. McChrystal testified in a previous investigation that he had decided not to tell the Tillman family of friendly fire, quote, based on my thought that providing incorrect information before an initial investigation was complete was not in the normal line of policies. However, Army regulation requires that families be notified when such an investigation is underway, not when it is completed. Like several other officers involved in the case, McChrystal testifies that he did not know about the rules. So here we have McChrystal, who's noted even by the corporate media as being part of the Black Ops corporate clandestine operation, a joint special operation commander, or someone in the command operations who fights in the shadows, quote unquote, in the battles of Iraq and Afghanistan. So once again, who really knows what happened to Tillman with all the contradictory evidence and with all the lies and deceit and operatives lurking in the shadows? Even Kevin Tillman, who wrote after Pat's birthday, had some questions and concerns when he noted, quote, it is Pat's birthday on November 6th. The elections are the day after. It gets me thinking about a conversation I had with Pat before we joined the military. He spoke about the risk with signing the paper, how once we committed, we were at the mercy of the American leadership and the American people, how we could be thrown in a direction not of our own volition, how fighting as a soldier we would leave us without a voice until we got out. Much has happened since we handed over our voice. Somehow, we were sent to invade a nation because it was a direct threat to the American people, or the world, or harbored terrorists, or was involved in the September 11th attacks, or received weapon-grade uranium from Niger, or had mobile weapons labs, or WMDs, or had a need to be liberated, or we needed to establish a democracy, or stop an insurgency, or stop a civil war we created that can't be called a civil war, even though it is. Something like that. Somehow our elected leaders were subverting international law and humanity by setting up secret prisons around the world, secretly kidnapping people, secretly holding them indefinitely, secretly not charging them with anything, secretly torturing them. Somehow, that overt policy of torture became the fault of a few bad apples in the military. Somehow, back at home, support for the soldiers meant having a five-year-old kindergarten scribble a picture with crayons and send it overseas, or slapping stickers on cars, or lobbying Congress for an extra pad and a helmet. It's interesting that a soldier on his third or fourth tour should care about a drawing from a five-year-old or a faded sticker on a car as his friends die around him, or an extra pad and a helmet as if it will protect him when an IED throws his vehicle 50 feet into the air as his body comes apart and his skin melts into the sea. Somehow, the more soldiers that die, the more legitimate the illegal invasion becomes. Somehow, American leadership, whose only credit is lying to its people and illegally invading a nation, has been allowed to steal the courage, virtue, and honor of its soldiers on the ground. Somehow, those afraid to fight an illegal invasion decades ago are allowed to send soldiers to die for an illegal invasion they started. Somehow, faking character, virtue, and strength is tolerated. Somehow, profiting from tragedy and horror is tolerated. Somehow, the death of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people is tolerated. Somehow, subversion of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution is tolerated. Somehow, suspension of habeas corpus is supposed to keep the country safe. Somehow, torture is tolerated. Somehow, lying is tolerated. Somehow, reason is being discarded for faith, dogma, and nonsense. Somehow, American leadership managed to create a more dangerous world. Somehow, a narrative is more important than reality. Somehow, America has become a country that projects everything that it is not and condemns everything that it is. Somehow, the most reasonable, trusted, and respected country in the world has become one of the most irrational, belligerent, feared, and distrusted countries in the world. Somehow, being politically informed, diligent, and skeptical has been replaced by apathy through active ignorance. Somehow, the same incompetent, narcissistic, virtueless, vivacious, malicious criminals are still in charge of this country. Somehow, this is tolerated. Somehow, nobody is accountable for this. In a democracy, the policy of the leaders is the policy of the people. So don't be shocked when our grandkids bury much of this generation as traitors to the nation, to the world, and to humanity. Most likely, they will come to know that somehow, was nurtured by fear, insecurity, and indifference, leaving the country vulnerable to unchecked, unchallenged parasites. Luckily, this country is still a democracy. People still have a voice. People still can take action. It can start after Pat's birthday. Well, as far as what this country truly represents, it's much further down the hole than anyone's birthday can ever see through. But somehow, in reality, the slaves must revolt. So while you G.I. Joes and Pats are getting blasted out of existence, exposing your disposability, the conversation concerning and uncovering the truth about your destruction basically plays out like this.
President, you speak often about taking care of the troops and honoring their sacrifices. The family of Corporal Pat Tillman believes there was a cover-up regarding his death, and some say perhaps it was even murder instead of just friendly fire. At a hearing last week on Capitol Hill, your former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, other officials used some version of "I don't recall" 82 times. When it was his turn to step up, Pat Tillman gave up a lucrative NFL career, served his country, and paid the ultimate sacrifice. Now you have a chance to pledge to the family that your government, your administration, will finally get to the bottom of it. Will you make that pledge to the family today that you'll finally, after 7 investigations, find out what really happened?
Well, first of all, I can understand why Pat Tillman's family, you know, has got significant emotions. As a man they loved and respected was killed while he's serving his country. I always admired the fact that a person who was relatively comfortable in life would be willing to take off one uniform and put on another to defend America. And the best way to honor that commitment of his is to find out the truth. And I'm confident the Defense Department wants to find out the truth, too, and we'll lay it out for the Tillman family to know.
There's been 7 investigations, and the Pentagon has not gotten to the bottom of it. Can you also tell us when you personally found out that it was not enemy fire, that it was friendly fire?
And I can't give you the precise moment.
But obviously, the minute I heard that the facts that most people believe were true were not true, that I expect there to be a full investigation and get to the bottom of it.
This is all a con game. 7 fake investigations, and we'll still, quote-unquote, somehow get to the bottom of it? Specialist Brian O'Neill, the last GI to see Tillman alive, was told not to tell the Tillman family the truth, that he was killed by U.S. forces. The evidence shows that he was killed probably from around 10 yards away. 3 bullet holes in the forehead. First of all, you don't keep standing after the first shot in the head. So the likelihood of this being friendly fire is extremely suspect. An Army attorneys sent each other congratulatory emails for keeping criminal investigations at bay as the Army conducted an internal friendly fire investigation that resulted in administrative or non-criminal punishment. That's the reality of what happened. The 3-star general who kept the truth from Tillman's family and the public told investigators some 70 times that he had a bad memory and couldn't recall details of his actions. No evidence at all of enemy fire was ever found at the scene. No one was hit by enemy fire, nor was any government equipment struck. So if that's the case, then why was there friendly fire? Why were they shooting if there didn't even appear to be enemies around? Obviously, something is wrong. But in a world where a buffoon can get up and make a few patriotic slogans, and the gumpified American population will obediently go to sleep, well, that basically means unless you're in revolt on your own, you're simply a flesh-covered puppet. But to make matters even worse, while the Empire screams about this war being carried out in part because of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, or what they would have you believe they thought, on September 6, 2007, Salon Magazine by Sidney Blumenthal, an article came out stating Bush knew Saddam had no weapons of mass destruction. CIA Director Tenet briefed President Bush in the Oval Office on top secret intelligence that Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction, according to 2 former senior CIA officers. Bush dismissed as worthless this information from the Iraqi foreign minister, a member of Saddam's inner circle, although it turned out to be accurate in every detail. Tenet never brought it up again. I could go on, but I think you get the point. This whole thing is calculated. It's constructed from 9/11 on. It's a scam. And yes, you as a G.I. Joe and beyond are flesh-covered puppets. So as we can see, this was and is designed and is a design of imperial resource control within an occupational program where these false flags and black op programs and genocide go together like lemonade and ice. These dollar-based imperialists know no bounds by humanity or anything else. And the quagmire that the empire is in is by design, which is how the next step in this evolving genocidal capitalist rage, this is how it can be played out, like this.
They were our enemies in Iraq, now they're our allies in Iraq. They're also thugs. They beat their captives, they torture them and conduct roadside executions, and some have the blood of Americans on their hands. Tonight, an exclusive look at forces now being called America's militia. Their tough tactics have proven effective in one part of Iraq, but will those tactics work in Baghdad and elsewhere? We'll investigate. We begin, however, with one big reason why American forces and Sunni tribal killers now work side by side. Necessity and a ticking clock. Today in Washington, lawmakers heard from the operational commander in Iraq and Washington's ambassador to Baghdad.
If there is one word that I would use to sum up the atmosphere in Iraq, on the street, in the countryside, in the neighborhoods, and at the national level, that word would be fear.
Fear. Beyond that, Ambassador Crocker said that meeting a September deadline for meaningful progress in Iraq will be difficult. Crocker did point to progress against Al-Qaeda in Anbar province. Now, only on 360 tonight, you'll see how that is being achieved. But we want to warn you, you're about to see war the way it really is. Here's CNN's Michael Ware.
This is one of America's new allies, the enemy of our enemy, beating a suspected Al-Qaeda member, threatening to kill him. He is part of America's success against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. A member of a Sunni militia group supported by the US to target Al-Qaeda. In this operation north of Baghdad, his group, no uniforms, their faces covered, are working hand in hand with local police and army units, and drawn from insurgent groups and local tribes. These are fighters who've been killing Americans and now use some American-supplied ammunition and US military support to turn on Al-Qaeda. Enemies of the US, now supported by the US.
In Anbar province, Sunni tribes that were once fighting alongside Al-Qaeda against our coalition are now fighting alongside our coalition against Al-Qaeda. We're working to replicate the success in Anbar and other parts of the country.
And this is Anbar. Grainy video posted 2 weeks ago on an Islamist website shows US-aligned militia unloading another Al-Qaeda prisoner from a police pickup. The man in charge asks his prisoner if he killed someone called Khalid. And then, taunting, tells him to say hi to Khalid for me. Cursing their prisoner, the makeshift firing squad leads him to a spot near an embankment. And he's executed. Why would these insurgents and tribesmen turn on Al-Qaeda to work with the Americans? The answer? Power, money, contracts, and control over their neighborhoods. And while few mourn the deaths of Al-Qaeda fighters anywhere, summary executions and excessive force by militias sponsored by the US is not something American commanders say they condone nor see. Brigadier General Mark McDonald.
We don't allow that, and we do not encourage that. We will stop that if we see it.
That said, the general also says he's not seen reports of abuses himself. But another senior U.S. official does say the militia's methods are an ugly side of the war here in Iraq. Ugly, but effective. In the militia-controlled areas, Al-Qaeda has not been defeated, but it's certainly been blunted. The capital of Anbar reclaimed from its grip, and attacks across the province spectacularly reduced, with similar signs emerging in other areas. The successes of the Sunni militias, however, come at a price. The Shia-dominated government in Baghdad is not happy, wary of U.S. support for armed Sunni groups. This support scares us, says Hadi al-Amri, commanding a powerful Shia militia. He is Iraq's equivalent to the chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the U.S. Working with these people is very dangerous, he says. We told the Americans we won't accept under any circumstances their being open to armed Sunni militia like the Islamic Army of Iraq or the brigades of the 1920 revolution. Two of the very groups the US has been courting and supporting. And this former national security minister, now heading a parliamentary oversight body, claims the US is overstepping its authority. That these tribes are armed beyond the government's control might lead to conflict, he says, suggesting they may be an American counterbalance to a government accused of links to Iranian-backed militia from the Shia community.
There's nothing that the multinational force, the Corps, is doing with, by name, by numbers, by place, by location, by intent, that we don't share with the government of Iraq.
With few signs of progress from the central government, America's former insurgent enemies seem to have given US commanders something the Iraqi government rarely has, a success story.
So you can see what once again is taking place. As they talk about these guys being thugs, but they're good thugs now because they're America's militia, even though they torture people. But as it's framed in the corporate media on CNN, that's a necessity because we have a clicking clock. But the reason why there's a so-called clicking clock, which is part of the propaganda, without breaking down the situation, is that the clicking clock is a quagmire. But the quagmire is by design. It's a quagmire by intentional imperial design. The quagmire that has been fomented by the U.S. Empire is used to expand the war. So you have these Sunni militias who were once fighting Americans, now fighting against Al-Qaeda. Now, Al-Qaeda is a ubiquitous term, as you know, because the network and all of this. Because in reality, we know that these various networks are a component of the U.S. military imperial apparatus. So, whether you are called Al-Qaeda in these types of covert insurgency mode operations and black flag and false flag operations is whether or not you are overtly working with SAM or not. If you're overtly working with SAM, now you're part of America's militia. If you're not, you can be part of the Al-Qaeda network that still is often working in the interest of SAM, you know, i.e. by creating chaos and conflict and sowing seeds between Sunnis and Shia and tribalism and all of that. But that's done covertly under the guise of plausible deniability. So we see that through these types of networks, they're expanding the chaos intentionally. It's a quagmire by design. Which is why, as I pointed out, the US GI Joes and James, they're just caught in the crosshairs themselves. Because while they're engaged in a particular war, their war is not really designed for them to defeat the insurgents. It's designed to be an occupational mode that helps us bring chaos, demoralization, the stress disorder on the overall population, to crush the population of the Iraqi people as a whole. Whereas the various PSYOPs operations and what have you is designed to escalate and expand the war in these covert cell operations and American militia formations and breaking these people off into these tribalized things and operate with them, fund both sides at certain times, etc., etc. So now what we have is a situation where the Washington Monthly came out with an article by Andrew Tigman called The Myth of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Some of it goes like this. In March 2007, a pair of truck bombs tore through the Shiite marketplace in the northern Iraqi city of Tal Afar, killing more than 150 people. The blast reduced the ancient city center to rubble, leaving body parts and charred vegetables scattered amid pools of blood. It was among the most lethal attacks to date in the five-year-old Iraq war. Within hours, Iraqi officials in Baghdad had pinned the bombing on Al-Qaeda. And news reports from Rutgers, the BBC, MSNBC, and others carried those remarks around the world. An internet posting by the terrorist group known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq took credit for the destruction. Within a few days, U.S. Army General David Petraeus publicly blamed Al-Qaeda in Iraq for the carnage, accusing the group of trying to foment sectarian violence and ignite a civil war. Back in Washington, pundits latched on to the attack with special interest, as President Bush had previously touted a period of calm in Tal Afar as evidence that the military retool counterinsurgency doctrine was working. For days, reporters and bloggers debated whether the attack signaled a resurgence, quote-unquote, of Al-Qaeda in the city. Yet there's reason to doubt that Al-Qaeda in Iraq had any role in the bombing. In the weeks before the attack, sectarian tensions had been simmering after a local Sunni woman told Al Jazeera television that she had been gang raped by a group of Shiite Iraqi army soldiers. Multiple insurgent groups called for violence to avenge the woman's honor. Immediately after the blast, some in uniform expressed doubts about Al-Qaeda's alleged role and suggested that homegrown sectarian strife was more likely at work. Quote, it's really not Al-Qaeda who had infiltrated so much as the fact of what happened in 2003, unquote, said Ahmed Hashim, a professor at the Naval War College who served as an Army political advisor to the 3rd Cavalry Regiment in Tal Afar until shortly before the bombing. Quote, the formerly dominant Sunni Turkmen majority there, he told PS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer soon after the bombing, suddenly felt themselves having been thrown out of power, and this is essentially their revenge. A week later, Iraqi security forces raided a home outside of Tal Afar, arrested two men suspected of orchestrating the bombing, yet when the U.S. military issued a press release about the arrest, there was no mention of Al-Qaeda connection. The suspects were never formally charged, and nearly 6 months later, neither the U.S. military nor Iraqi police are certain of the source of the attack. In recent public statements, the military has backed off its former allegations that Al-Qaeda was responsible, instead asserting, as Lieutenant Colonel Michael Donnelly wrote in response to an inquiry from the Washington Monthly, that, quote, the tactics used in this attack are consistent with Al-Qaeda, unquote. This scenario has become common after a strike. The military rushes to point the finger at Al-Qaeda, even when the actual evidence remains hazy and an alternative explanation, raw hatred between local Sunnis and Shiites, might fit the circumstances just as well. Let me stop right there. See, I point this out, that this long evidence, as you can see in Tilghman's article, that goes on much longer, that this whole Al-Qaeda thing and who is Al-Qaeda cannot be understood within the confines of how the corporate media describes it. The history of these various federations that evolved out of the U.S. Empire's Mujahideen Black Ops operation days gives a more honest lineage. And that lineage is still effectively used today in SAM's covert operating apparatus. Now, when they talk about you have these various groups who are armed beyond the Shia government control, and that's dangerous, and it is a counterbalance to the Tehran government, who is backing the Shia government in Iraq. Basically, what you are seeing is a situation where SAM is intentionally backing groups that will have the power just by the chaos and stress that they are engaged in to undermine the puppet regime that they have in place, and then help justify the developmental progression of war and threats against Iran as they outline the connection between Iran and the Iraqi government in certain Shia groups. Furthering the whole quagmire situation because of how they are operating within these spectrums to create the chaos and thereby escalate and expand the war throughout the Middle East and Eurasia, which is part of their global strategy in the first place. So as I've been stressing, this is a quagmire by design. And the U.S. G.I. Joes and Janes are mere flesh puppets, stooges, expendable toilet paper in this expansion of war by the Pentagon. So as they keep expanding it, it is creating all of these occupational stress disorders. These cause internal political quagmires and confusion in America, socially, economically, politically. And they cause political, social, economic, and physical war quagmires in Iraq. It stresses out the puppet government, the Iraqi people. The insurgents there are mere flesh puppets themselves. One minute they're fighting U.S. forces, the next minute they're aligned with them. They're just puppets. And it intensifies, though, the international Mideast quagmire, especially with regions like Iran, who is on SAM's most immediate imperial gun sight. As the administrators of the imperial order make clear themselves, August 30th, 2007, hit Iran where it hurts, by Barack Obama. Americans need to come together to confront the challenge posed by Iran, Yet the Bush administration and an anonymous senator are blocking a bill with bipartisan support that would ratchet up the pressure on the Iranian regime. It's time for this obstructionism to stop. The decision to wage a misguided war in Iraq has substantially strengthened Iran, which now poses the greatest strategic challenge to U.S. interests in the Middle East. In a generation, Iran supports violent groups and sectarian politics in Iraq, fuels terror and extremism across the Middle East, and continues to make progress on its nuclear program in defiance of the international community. Meanwhile, Iran president has declared that Israel must be wiped off the map. So what this huckster Obama is doing, by misdirection, is also purporting the escalation. And by pretending that this was a misguided war, that, you know, given the image that, you know, Bush and them just fumbled their way into it. But now that we're there, it strengthened Iran. So now we got to take care of business with Iran. These are quagmires by design. These are psyops operations by the administrators and physical chaos by the elite in the war theater to justify further escalation. The reality is when they first came into Iraq, if they had not disbanded the 250,000 Iraqi military, if they had not kicked out all the civil workers, if they had given many of the contracts to the middle and upper middle class Iraqi people, so that they could thereby employ their own Iraqi people in the rebuilding effort, open up the schools immediately, got the power grids working, what we see going on today would not have happened. But it was not in their interest for that to not take place, for that to take place. It was in their interest for the occupational stress disorder to take root. It was in their imperial interest for the quagmire, by imperial design, to escalate and justify their escalation of this imperial war, which you can read out of the lips of Obama himself. Meanwhile, as Steve Watson noted, the Iraq mission accomplished. They're not fighting us anymore. They're fighting each other. As chaos reaches all-time high, coalitions prepare to scale back occupation and march onwards towards Syria and Iran. Death tolls in Iraq are hitting all-time highs, and the worst cases of sectarian violence of the entire war are rampant throughout the country. Amid the chaos, the government has declared that everything is going well enough in Iraq for forces to be withdrawn. This statement is accurate. The strategy has always been one of this disillusion and destabilization. We are not cutting and running because the mission has been accomplished. The AP is reporting, in the deadliest attack on sectarian enclaves since the beginning of the Iraq war, suspected Sunni Arab militants used 3 suicide car bombs and 2 mortar rounds on the capital Shiite Sadr city slum to kill at least 150 people and wound 238 on Thursday, police said. The Shiites responded almost immediately by firing 10 mortar rounds at the Abu Hafni Sunni mosque and killing 1 person and wounding 14 people in an attack on the holiest Sunni shrine in Baghdad. Sectarian fighting also broke in another part of northern Iraq on Thursday, when 30 Sunni insurgents armed with machine guns and mortars attacked the Shiite-controlled health ministry building. The UN also this week reported that 3,709 Iraqi civilians were killed in October, the highest monthly toll of the war. More than 3,700 were killed, with hundreds bearing signs of torture and execution-style killings, said the report. As I've been saying, this is by design. Reports have shown that more than 1 million Iraqis have been murdered in household surveys since the 2003 occupation. Well more than 1 million. Over 1,200,000. Part of the CNN, corporate media, Fox News, all that garbage role is framing these issues to inflame the psyops, misdirection, and enable the expanding quagmire by imperial design. Meanwhile, as CIA cells are fully operational in Iran right now. This is the way of the beast. And as Hanan Alam wrote in the August 27, 2007 article by McCaffrey newspaper, that quote, Iraq's deadly insurgent groups have financed their war against U.S. troops in parts with hundreds of thousands of dollars in U.S. rebuilding funds that they extort from Iraqi contractors in Anbar province. The payments in return for the insurgents, allowing supplies to move and construct work to begin, have taken place since the earliest projects in 2003, Iraqi contractors, politicians, and interpreters involved with the reconstruction effort said. A fresh round of rebuilding spurred by the U.S. military recent alliance with some Anbar tribes, 200 new projects are scheduled, provides another opportunity for militant groups such as Al-Qaeda in Iraq to siphon off more U.S. funds, contractors and politicians warn. Quote, now we're back to the same old story in Anbar. The Americans are handing out contracts and jobs to terrorists, bandits, and gangsters. Unquote, said Sheikh Ali Hatim, the deputy leader of the Zuliam, the largest and most powerful tribe in Anbar. He was involved in several U.S. rebuilding contracts in the early days of the war, but is now a harsh critic of the U.S. presence. Once again, they have these guys coming and going. And at the same time, the U.S. GIs, Joes and James, are simply caught in the crosshair because their role is basically to crush and defeat the Iraqi people in their occupational mode. But what goes on underground and above their heads, in many ways, they have no clue, which is why they're so expendable. Because the whole design is to stress out the population, to eventually break it up. This takes long-term efforts. You don't just break up a state overnight. You have to grind it down, sectarianize it, tribalize it, hocus-pocusize it in its various hocus-pocus sects, demoralize it, have the youngest engaged in fratricidal and genocidal behavior, have massive brain drains and internal displacement, have many of the intellectuals leave the country altogether. But those take those issues and strategies take time. And the G.I. Joes must be prepared to be disposable flesh puppets in that process. So in Iraq, from the imperial grand chessboard elite order's perspective, everybody's your enemy.
Michael Ware joins us now from Baghdad, along with CNN military analyst, retired Brigadier General David Grange. Michael, it was a fascinating piece. The strategy of arming Sunnis to fight al-Qaeda, something we've been talking about, you and I have been talking about since I first met you in Iraq in the beginning of all this. It appears to be working in al-Anbar. Can it be applied to the rest of Iraq?
Well, can it be applied to the rest of Iraq, Anderson? The truth is, that's how this country is run. It's the militias who have the lid on Iraq, not the U.S. military. The only problem for the U.S. is that the bulk of these militias that control most of the territory and have their hooks into the central government are supplied and backed by Iran. What you're now seeing are the militias that are being backed by the U.S. This tells us two things. One, this shows us a picture of how the war is being fought here in Iraq and won, certainly in some areas, in America's name. The second thing is, this is a foretaste of the future. When US troops withdraw, it's going to be militia on militia. And ultimately, America or its Arab allies are going to be supporting one side or the other. And you're looking at the side that they will support.
Well, General Grange, how do we know that these guys in al-Anbar who we're now supporting, who were once fighting against us, won't eventually turn back against us?
Well, we don't know. The issue you have here is everybody your enemy. I mean, you can't kill everybody in Iraq. So the idea to get one of the enemies to turn on one of your other enemies, you know, tactically, may be okay. But there's some consequences. I do believe with the comments of the American commanders that these things are not condoned. But it happens not only with the militias, it also happens with the Iraqi army, even though it's wrong. But yeah, they could turn on you. Sure they can.
Michael, Prime Minister al-Maliki and others in the parliament were voicing concerns over the strategy in your story, saying it could create new militias. A legitimate concern, but kind of hypocritical for Shia political leaders who have their own militias to be condemning other militias.
Absolutely, Anderson. I mean, government-run death squads have been operating in this country for pretty much the best part of 2 years now. And yeah, this government really is just a loose alliance of Iranian-backed Shia militias themselves. So it really is the pot calling the kettle black. But what their comments highlight is that what they see is behind the initial fight against al-Qaeda, America is backing these guys as a balance against the very government America created and has lost influence over. That's their fear.
General Grant, I want to read you something that Major General Rick Lynch, a commander in the south of Baghdad, said about enlisting these guys, these Sunni insurgents. He said, quote, "I'm not going to go out and negotiate with folks who have American blood on their hands." How should the U.S. military deal with the fact that some of these Sunnis were helping do, I mean, they've killed Americans?
Well, but the thing is, how do you know who they are? I mean, how do you know actually who killed Americans? I mean, no one wants to coordinate and collaborate with someone that has American blood on their hands, but I'm not sure how you can sort that out. I think in a regular warfare, unconventional warfare, you have to collaborate with some groups in order to be successful. I like the word that Michael used on balance. You know, it was getting out of balance with the Shia backed by Iran. You have the Sunni piece here, backed by Saudi Arabia and others, that you're working with. The government is somewhat non-effective right now. You have al-Qaeda as one of the threats that can reach out and touch us, not necessarily out of Iraq, but the whole network of al-Qaeda. And so that's a bigger enemy. But I think you have to collaborate with some groups in order to be successful. I don't know any other way around it.
Michael, how likely is it, if there is some sort of pullout or drawdown or redeployment of U.S. troops, whatever you want to, however you want to spin it or call it, how likely is full-scale civil war? If we're not already in a full-scale civil war, just a massive bloodletting.
Yeah, I think it's almost guaranteed. I mean, these guys already are champing at the bit to start tearing at each other. Indeed, the senior power brokers
within this government, the people who you generally don't see on TV, we've been talking to them, and they find it very difficult to mask their true intentions. When I ask these Shia militia commanders in the government, are you concerned about a US withdrawal? Are you worried about the violence that will follow? They're virtually smiling when they say, no, we the Shia, we're ready. It's the Sunni who should be worried. I think that tells you a lot.
Michael Ware, appreciate the reporting as always. Brigadier General David Grange, your expertise. Thank you very much.
So once again, you can see how it's framed, and you can see how the game plan for Empire is moving straight ahead. As the CNN guy stated, when U.S. troops withdraw, quote unquote, you know, they're building all these embassies and bases and everything else, but it's going to be militia on militia. And it comes down to what militias Sam backs and his allies support versus the other side. Or in other words, U.S. interests are still going to be in play, regardless of your version of withdrawal, which means that the chaos, the quagmire, will continue and spread. Which means the permanent war stage, which is what this expanding war for empire within this dollar and change order is all about. The idea, as this general said, that everybody is your enemy is basically the mindset of the elite, the order. Humankind is their enemy. The slaves are their enemy. Is it not time that us slaves realize that these flesh peddlers are truly our enemy and not be emblazoned in their divide and conquer false flag psyops games? Because as they state, it was getting out of balance. The Shia backed by the Iran. Now we're back. So this is what we have to do to quote unquote bring it back to balance. This is this rhetoric. These are this coded words for creating the quagmire syndrome and destabilization to spread and use these divisional tactics as a mechanism for expansion of quagmire by imperial design. And they have, as one Shia said, we're ready for the Sunnis. That's spoken like a good little psyops, hocus-pocus drone caught in the whirlwind of the quagmire by imperial design, by the order, stressed out and occupied on Sam's Arab plantation land, falling further and further down that bombed out rabbit hole. Simply Sam's plaything, playing his terror card, playing his insurgents card. playing his Al-Qaeda card. And of course, playing his Bin Laden card. But what about this card once again, meaning the Bin Laden card? Ed Haas, The Muckraker Report, June 6, 2006. This past weekend, a thought-provoking email circulated through internet news groups and was sent to the Muckraker Report by Mr. Paul Sheridan, winner of the 2005 Civil Justice Foundation Award, bringing attention to the FBI's Most Wanted Terrorist webpage for Osama bin Laden. In the email, the question is asked, why doesn't Osama bin Laden's Most Wanted poster make any direct connection with the events of September 11, 2001? The FBI says on its bin Laden webpage that Osama bin Laden is wanted in connection with the August 7, 1998 bombing of the United States embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya. According to the FBI, these attacks killed over 200 people. The FBI concludes its reason for wanting bin Laden by saying, quote, in addition, bin Laden is a suspect in other terrorist attacks throughout the world. On June 5th, 2006, the Muckraker Report contacted the FBI headquarters to learn why bin Laden's Most Wanted poster did not indicate that Osama was also wanted in connection with 9/11. The Muckraker Report spoke with Rex Tom, chief of the investigative publicity for the FBI. When asked why there is no mention of 9/11 on bin Laden's Most Wanted webpage, Tom said, quote, the reason why 9/11 is not mentioned on Osama bin Laden's Most Wanted webpage is because the FBI has no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11, unquote. Surprised by the ease in which the FBI spokesman made such an astonishing statement, I asked, how is this possible? Tom continued, quote, bin Laden has not been formally charged in connection to 9/11. I asked, how does that work? Tom continued, the FBI gathers evidence. Once evidence is gathered, it is turned over to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice then decides whether it has enough evidence to present to the federal grand jury. In the case of the 1998 United States embassies being bombed, bin Laden has been formally indicted and charged by the grand jury. He has not been formally indicted and charged in connection with 9/11 because the FBI has no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. Let me stop right there. Once again, this article by Ed Haas helps outline the scam that's going on, how the war is justified, how it's expanded, who the so-called enemies are and are not. And wait, one last thing. What about the Taliban Afghanistan clowns Sam started this global grand chessboard strategy against? Well, quote, the last time Ratamullah Hashmani came to Yale, it was March 2001, and he was a Taliban spokesman in a turban and Afghan tunic, singing the praises of his fundamentalist masters. 5 years on, Mr. Ratamala, 27, is in his first year as a student at the Ivy League University, whose illustrious list of alumni begins with the president and previous two presidents. Dressed in trainers, a fleece, a blue shirt, and slacks, he could pass for any Yale undergraduate. He is upset to have done worse than expected on his paper on terrorism. Past, present, and future. A surprising failure, perhaps, for a former advisor to Mullah Muhammad Omar, the reclusive leader of the radical Islamic Afghan movement. Quote, "In some ways, I've been the luckiest person in the world," unquote, Mr. Rahmata told the New York Times from his bedsit off the Yale campus in Connecticut. Quote, "I could have ended up in Guantanamo Bay. Instead, I ended up at Yale," unquote. He admitted to missing his wife and two children, now living in Pakistan border city of Quetta with his parents. There's also difficulty with academic English. When he got a B+ on an earlier paper, he called it a B+. Well, B+. GI flesh puppets, as you're dying from cancer, heads being blown and chopped off, being caught in intentional imperial quagmire that has your expendability and disposability at heart. You could be like this Taliban guy, fighting his way up and down the corridors of Yale, having to worry about what term papers he's going to write and what grades he's going to have, instead of being blown to bits like flesh puppets like yourself on the grand chessboard as Iraq slips intentionally into the second most failed state on the planet. I think it's clear. One needs, if one is to survive, to wake up and smell one's own burning flesh. That being a puppet for empire is being a disposable clown. Nothing more than a disposable soiled piece of toilet paper out of the behind of Boy George. Hold on a sec. The rabbit hole while you can, because if you don't, all you're going to witness is more darkness. Until the next time, slave out.